Welcome everybody, and today is April 23rd. I'm going to go ahead and start with opening a work session on House Bill 3161. And I'm going to have to hold this one over and should have the amendments to this on Friday. So we'll be adding 3161 or moving it over till Friday. And then I'm going to close the work session. Yes.
Madam Chair, we are planning on meeting on Friday then.
We are.
And Madam Chair, I beg your pardon, but I will be in Houston, Texas that day with my grandchildren. So I will not be here that day.
I won't be here that day either, I think, Madam Chair. Maybe for a little while.
Uh-oh. Grandson turns 8 years old that day, and I'm going to be there for his 8th birthday on a special function for him. So.
Representative Tillman. Well, unless you want to work until midnight on Monday, committee.
I'll be here, Madam Chair.
We'll be able to make all the businesses do.
All right. House Bill, I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3527. And Judith, remind us.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. This is Representative Buckley's race activity vehicle bill. We have before us now the Dash 3 amendments. Those amendments set the registration fee for those vehicles at $81. It exempts them from registration requirements if the vehicle is being test-driven within a 30-mile radius of the manufacturer's location. It creates a Class B traffic violation for violating the registration limits if the person uses the vehicle for other than the following activities: exhibitions, parades, or club activities, driving the vehicle to a racetrack within a 90-mile radius of the person's home, or test driving the vehicle for maintenance or repair purposes. It also creates a similar Class B traffic violation for the offense of unlawfully operating a race activity vehicle if the vehicle is operated on a highway that has a posted speed limit that is greater than 55 miles per hour.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry, I zoned off when you just said that. And I missed that point. Could you say that again? I'm sorry.
No problem. Madam Chair, Representative Smith, so we're talking about two different violations here, both Class B traffic violations, which can have a fine of up to $360. In the first case, it would be a violation of the registration limits if the person is driving the vehicle in areas that they're not allowed to. That is, they are allowed to drive to and from exhibitions, parades, and club activities, to test drive it after it's been repaired or some maintenance work has been done, or if you're driving it to a racetrack. But any driving it for any other purpose then would be a violation of the registration limit.
Can I just ask one quick question, Madam Chair?
Yes.
Just really quick. When it says 90-mile radius, does that mean if I'm, and I just want to be clear on this, if I'm standing, sorry folks, you can't see this here, is it 90 miles or is it 45?
Radius.
It's a 90-mile radius.
Radius, not diameter.
Thank you. And do well in geometry. Thank you.
And then, Madam Chair, Representative Smith, to be clear, then there's a separate violation for unlawfully operating it if they're operating it on a highway that has a greater than 55 mile an hour speed limit. Both of those being Class B traffic violations with up to a $360 fine.
That's dangerous.
Thank you, Judith. Committee, any questions for the sponsor of the bill?
Madam Chair, I just need to make sure I understand that which we had previously. We're still talking about a license plate for this, a registration as well as a license plate. But the testimony, as I recall from Jack Evans, was that there would be the limitations on the highways, but that there would be about $24,000 for programming and the various rules to develop the plates themselves for this 90-mile radius, 30 miles test-driven for these rigs that have this amount of horsepower under 205 to 300 horsepower. Does that... Maybe we better have Jack just confirm that.
It's a regular license plate.
It's a regular license plate, yeah.
Chair Breyer, members of the committee, Jack Evans of the Department of Transportation. Representative Butler, I believe that the license plate for this vehicle would be a permanent registration plate, and it would be registered, it can be registered as a special use vehicle, I believe is the term. In order to program this definition into the computer, that's where the costs are, not necessarily to create a new license plate. It's to do the programming for the registration of this definition of a vehicle.
And Madam Chair, was the amount that you gave us, Jack, $24,000 for programming for that registration of a special use?
Chair Beyer, Representative Butler, I believe that is correct. I don't have the, unfortunately, that number with me right here, but I believe that that's the bulk of it is primarily the programming, and then there's some also some additional implementation costs just associated with the staff time to put the stuff together.
Madam Chair. Representative Tomlin.
Thank you. Jack, so who would pay for this programming?
Chair Beyer, Representative Tomei, that is paid for by DMV out of the highway fund, I believe.
Follow up.
So
the public is having to pay for this programming to allow these very specialized vehicles to be on the highway, not the freeway, but on the highway, or at least, I guess, on the freeway for 55 miles an hour or less.
Chair by Representative Tomei, that's correct.
Follow up.
So how many vehicles are there that would fit this classification currently?
Chair Beyer, Representative Tomei, there are none in Oregon that are currently registered. This would allow registration of them on the road, and I guess I would have to defer to Representative Buckley, perhaps, to give us an estimate of how many could be out there. We don't anticipate there would be very many.
Madam Chair and Co-Chair Tomei, currently the Brenmo is turning out 1.5 cars per week. And in terms of sales for Oregon, I believe, if I remember correctly, we have 10 right now in the state of Oregon. So this is not yearly there will not be a large number of vehicles per year registered in the state. And I guess I would suggest that this is an investment in a company that is going to hopefully be a long-term economic force in Southern Oregon as they develop their lines of cars. They have a variety of vehicles following this one that are not racing activity vehicles. This is their front-of-the-line car that is raising money for them to develop their electric cars and other electric motorcycles and other vehicles.
Representative Gilman.
Madam Chair, the way I do my math, it's about a subsidy of $2,000 a car. For people that are able to afford a nearly $100,000 car, I'm starting to have a little trouble, even though this is very close to my district and I do like to promote economic development. I don't know if I want to subsidize people quite that much.
Would it make a difference if they put a propeller on it, George?
No.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Jack, really quick, what was the rationale for keeping these off of vehicles with 55 mile an hour or higher designations?
Chair by Representative Smith, we were looking to put some restrictions on the use of these vehicles because the notion is that this type of a racing car you drive on race day from your home to the racetrack and then you open it up. And then we also added in the opportunity to be able to take it to be maintained and to test drive it around the manufacturing facility. We also thought it would be a good idea to keep it off of the the larger, like the I-5 types of highways, but recognize that in order to get some of these to some of these places like racetracks, et cetera, you probably would have to be able to negotiate roads that had speeds of 55 miles an hour. Originally, when we put it together, it came back with you'd be in violation if you were on a road that was 55. So this allows you to travel on a highway that's posted 55, essentially to be able to get to either the racetrack or test driver, that type of thing.
Just a quick observation, if I might. There's locations within, I guess this is an observation for everyone, there's locations within rural eastern Oregon where the speed limit is 65. And the only way you could get from one location to another is by taking that highway. The one that comes to mind is in Sherman County with Highway 97. If you lived in Moore or Grass Valley or Wasco, anywhere you go short of a dirt road, you're going to have to do that.
Highway 30 is a good example, Madam Chair. Highway 30 and it becomes I-84 in a number of places. Where you get in canyons that are so small it won't accommodate State Highway 30, it just becomes I-84. But I don't know how close that is to any current racetracks. There's a proposed racetrack very close to that, but.
Well, and I'm thinking of in Huntington. If you were in Huntington and you want to get to Baker City,
you have to be on the freeway.
Is I-84. So, just a thought.
Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a note too, the entrance of this classification into the database is a one-time cost. So it is definitely our hope that Brahma Motorsports will be in production in Southern Oregon for many years to come. So that cost will carry through for many years.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Tomei.
Is there anyone from the manufacturer here today?
Tell me, we had one here at their first public hearing, but there's no one here today from Brahma.
Okay. I still have some serious questions, and I'm not sure how much time you want to spend on this. But I would have a really hard time voting for this. In a past life, I used to go to a lot of races, and people would have very specialized cars, and they had them on trailers. They wouldn't have thought to put them on the road. And I can't imagine somebody who can afford these very expensive cars that they're going to be wanting to drive them on local roads. And certainly I can't imagine where in eastern Oregon or areas where there might be races that neighbors of Representative Smith, maybe they would be able to afford something like this. But it's a very specialized automobile, and it seems to me that you're traveling long ways to go to a place where there will be a race. So I just have a lot of trouble with that.
Certainly. Thank you. Representative Tomei, Brahma Motorsports asked me to bring this forward on their behalf. Their main desire was to be able to have customers who come from both within Oregon and outside the state to come to the factory in Ashland to watch their car being made, which is quite fantastic, and then to be able to register it and take it for a test drive, to drive it to Medford, to drive it a track, and you know, use the vehicle and show what it's like. Again, as the representative from Brahma mentioned during the testimony, that this is kind of taken off of, it's actually a replica of a British racing activity vehicle, and they're taking off that kind of format, which is apparently, according to his testimony, fairly common. And there is on the handout I provided during the last hearing on this, there's a variety of cars that are kit cars that are currently registered under Oregon law. And if you take a look at that, you'll see that these are vehicles that people do the same thing. They drive to the track, they race them on the track, and they come back. These ones will not have the same kind of strict requirements that the aerial autumn will have. It's a page titled Modern Kit Cars or Assembled Vehicles for reference.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair Meyer. I have to agree and admit, when I first heard the price tag of $26,000, my heart kind of went, you know, I thought, gosh, you know, perhaps Oregonians ought to foot the bill for themselves. But then I guess I had to step back and remember that in the state of Oregon, we spend millions and millions and millions of dollars on economic development. And for $26,000, if we can send a message to this company that Oregon supports you, I think that's a $26,000 investment that's well made. You know, I think it would be absolutely terrible for this body to say, is it Bromo Motorsports? We welcome you to Oregon. However, we're not willing to support you in the state of Oregon. And so if there's an opportunity for us to support an Oregon-based company for $26,000, I think that's a pittance compared to what we spend in the Economic and Community Development Department.
Thank you, Representative Smith. Representative Butler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This brings up one other question, and that is, can a manufacturer use, this was a question to Jack, can a manufacturer use a dealer plate? If a manufacturer could use a dealer plate, there'd be no question about folks that are coming from out of state and being able to use this. They wouldn't even have to register it in Oregon at that point, would they?
Chair Byer, Representative Butler, I don't believe that that's something we're going to have to look into, because I don't believe that Bramo Motorsports is registered in Oregon as a dealer. So there's some other issues that would have to be explored with respect to your question.
Well, I guess, Madam Chair, my point is that if we get a California buyer that does want to test drive the vehicle, which they have babied along from, you know, the first of the production line clear to the end, and that Bramo Motorsports would qualify themselves as a dealer, then they could in fact pick up a dozen or two dozen dealer plates and could demo those. I don't want to discourage Oregon registration, but at that particular point, those folks could would be a way to help them increase their production for out-of-state folks, and then still do, as Representative Smith has indicated, go ahead and allow the highway trust funds to use the $26,000 to defray the cost of, and the way that I calculated it wasn't 10 cars divided by the $24,000. I said over a period of 10 years, that's really about $240 a car. And that stays in Oregon, and I think for $240 a car, and I think we had testimony of the dozens of jobs that were presently on the line right now. These were all very top end line jobs, as well as a factory coming that is established in Oregon. I felt like that probably was a way to allay the concerns I had about the $24,000.
I think if I can comment very briefly, and I think the points brought up are very important. Bramo does want to be a long-term presence. They have created now 65 jobs. These are family wage jobs, really good jobs in the city of Ashland. They have an expansion plan. They recently bought a tennis court, a tennis club that was going out of business, but then pulled back because the members of the club felt so passionate about their tennis club they wanted to keep it, so they allowed the members to buy their own club, and they're looking to build another facility in Ashland. They are being courted by other states, and part of the reasons that I feel a sense of urgency with this bill is that they've made it clear that they want to be in Oregon. They would love Southern Oregon to be the kind of, as they say, the Detroit of the new vehicles, particularly alternative vehicles as they develop them online. And they do have plans to expand into the 300, 400, 500 job range, which would be crucial for my district and I think for the economic development of our state. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
I've changed my mind. When I hear about those jobs, I didn't realize it was 65 jobs currently and that they were building up to more. So I will be supportive.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Representative Smith.
Madam Chair, I thought it was the Twilight Zone for a moment where Representative Butler and I were just throwing cash and Representative
Turner.
Okay. Any other questions? Do you have a motion, anyone?
Madam Chair, the question I had was, we have a Dash 1 amendment that we had looked at last when we first met, and today we have a Dash 3, which must incorporate the Dash 1s in it. And I had notes in my files that in addition to the Dash 1s that we had before us, we needed the Dash 2. So I'm assuming that a Dash 3 takes care of all of the concerns that we had expressed last time in the ones which were present and the twos which were forthcoming.
Chair by Representative Butler, that's correct. The dash twos added the restrictions. When we got those amendments, we saw that the 55 mile an hour designation was incorrect. So the dash threes corrects that, so that the dash threes subsumes everything that you want to look at.
Madam Chair, I move the dash three amendment dated 4/20/07 be appended to House Bill 3527.
Representative Butler has moved the dash three amendments to House Bill 3527 dated 4/20/07. Any discussion? Seeing none, any objections? The amendments are adopted.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3527 be engrossed with the dash three amendments to be printed and presented to the floor of the House of Representatives with a due pass motion.
Thank you. Representative Butler has moved House Bill 3527 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Representative,
as some of you realize, I'm on the Economic Development Ways and Means, and as what we figure there, that if a job costs $1,500, that or if they bring that, each job brings in $1,500 in income tax. So I figured out that would be $97,000 that they would bring in income tax, so that more than pays up for that $24,000. So thank you for bringing this bill to us.
Thank you, Representative Tomei. Seeing no other discussion, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Buckley.
Aye.
Representative Butler.
Yes.
Representative Gilman.
Aye.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Representative Smith.
Aye.
Representative Tomei.
Aye.
Chair Byers.
Aye. House Bill 3527 is adopted. And
Peter's going to carry that, right, Peter?
Representative,
I would be honored to do so, and I appreciate the committee's time and consideration.
Thank you. Okay. Close the work session on House Bill 3527. I'm going to go ahead and open the work session on House Bill 2851. And Judith, would you remind us?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. House Bill 2851 is the measure that creates a task force on the transportation needs of persons with developmental disabilities. You do have the dash one amendments, and in fact, I have staff right now checking down a fiscal for you on the fiscal for the dash one amendments that modifies the task force membership. It also adds to the task force duties the identification and review of transportation needs and opportunities in the context of community living needs of the persons with disabilities. It extends the reporting time frame from January to October of 2008. And it would require Department of Human Services as well as the Department of Transportation to provide support for that task force. As I said, we are checking to see if by chance, I know the committee wanted to look at that fiscal before taking action on this measure, and we're going to check once. I just sent staff down to check to see if by chance we were going to have it before the end of this working day.
Thank you, Judith. Anybody who came to hear that bill, hopefully we might get there by the end of the session, this meeting. If not, we'll hold it over, and I'm going to go ahead and close the work session on House Bill 2851 and open I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2936.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. The original House Bill 2936 would require a name and address of a transferee to be provided by the person transferring a vehicle to another individual. You have before you the dash two amendments, which do replace the original bill. Those amendments decrease the registration fees for motorhomes from $126 down to $54. This may be familiar to you because we did actually have another bill that accomplish this, be used for another purpose, so it would be putting that language into this measure now. It would increase the length of a motor home up to 14 feet. If you look at on the dash two amendments, page 7, you'll see that the dash 2s increase the length of the motor home to 14 feet. Motorhomes then, again, increasing from 10 to 14 feet in length would pay an additional, a higher charge that's standard current law of $126 plus $7.50 per foot. The amendment says over 14 feet, they'd be paying that additional per foot registration fee. And finally, looking at page 10 and 11 of the dash 2 amendments, sections 2 and 3 deal with a totally different topic, and that is it would increase the penalty from a Class D traffic violation of $90 fine up to a $90 fine to a Class A traffic violation, which carries a fine of up to $720 for truck drivers who violate the provisions of their size and weight permits. Those are the things that now the dash 2s do that would replace the original House Bill 2936. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Judith. I am going to go ahead and call up Bob Russell and Jack Evans, if you'll come up together.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob Russell, President of the Oregon Trucking Associations. And House Bill 2936 is becoming a home for orphans. You may recall there's a couple of different bills. House Bill 2982 used for a different purpose, and then we had the Volkswagen ban issue, which is the first part of this bill. And then we had House Bill 2902, which was my original bill that dealt with size and weight penalties. And the part that went was it reduced size and weight penalties if you were perfectly legal but did not have a permit. But at the time, the second piece, legislative counsel told us, didn't fit into the relating clause. So the second piece is here, and it's the last two sections, sections 2 and 3. And what it does, it increases the penalties for somebody that doesn't follow the requirements of a size and weight permit. And the example that I gave you last time, which is the reason that we're actually bringing this bill, is mobile homes were coming down the Marion County roads, and according to their permit, they were supposed to have a pilot car in front and in the rear. But the cost of the pilot car was greater than the ticket. So they were not hiring the pilot cars, and they were risking getting the tickets. So Marion County asked me to increase the penalty so it was higher than the cost of the pilot cars so that they would hire the pilot cars and we would have safety on our roads. So that's what this piece does. It's the second part of that bill.
Thank you. Seeing Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. With this gun stuff, was Representative Jensen notified?
Yes. We did talk with him and have his permission.
The travel trailers or campers, what is it? Bob, I don't have any issue to do with you, does it?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, no, it doesn't. It was John Phillips that brought the issue forward, who happens to be a friend of mine, and for some reason he's not here. But it was the issue of the Volkswagen ban, and you may recall his testimony, and he felt like he was being overcharged because he was treated as a motorhome instead of a van, when in fact most of the time his vehicle was used as a van.
Thank you.
Thank you. And Representative Smith, I've chatted with him. We have a little bit of a problem with the amendment, so he'll probably wait until we actually are going to be able to pass it. Jack.
Chair Byer, members of the committee, Jack Evans, the Department of Transportation. The problem with the amendment is that to fix Mr. Phillips' problem, his issue, is that motorhomes over 10 feet currently are charged $126 plus $7.50 a foot. This would take the motorhome 6 to 14 feet pay $126. The amendment would change that to the smaller Volkswagen van size motorhomes. 6 to 14 feet would pay $54. That impact in revenue is about, for the first 18 months, is around $48,000, and for the second biennium is $64,000 in loss of revenue by reducing the fees, and those fees go to parks. The problem was that we missed in the initial fiscal looking at the impact on the larger vehicles. The Volkswagen van-sized vehicles, there's about 663 of them, and that generates that fairly small hit on revenue. There's a revenue hit of about $1.3 million. If you take into consideration that on the motorhomes that are greater than 14 feet in length, they pay $126 plus $7.50 per foot for every foot over 10 feet. This changes it to every foot over 14 feet. So there's $30 that's lost on the really big motorhomes, and there's 43,000 of them that we would register in the first 18 months, and then in the second biennium that jumps to about 58,000. Hence, it's a significantly different revenue impact suddenly. It goes to 1.3 and then $1.8 million to parks. But there's, a simple fix that should make everybody happy, including the Volkswagen owners, and it won't change anything for the large vehicles. And that's simply in line 18 of page 7, line 17 and 18, it says, for motorhomes over 14 feet in length, their fee is $126 plus $7.50 a foot for each foot of length over the first 14 feet. If you change that back to the first 10 feet, then it treats those large vehicles the same way they're being treated now. There's no loss of revenue for them. And the smaller vehicles that are the subject of this amendment, their solution would be kept intact. So we go back from a revenue hit of $1.3 million to one of $48,000 in the first remainder of this biennium.
Thank you. Any questions?
That's on line 18, Madam Chair. Is that right? On
page 7.
Page 7.
Yeah.
Madam Chair? That's a better hit.
any other discussion? Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I apologize to the committee for not being here. I had to speak at a funeral this day. Can one of you just update me, and I apologize again for not being here. What was the urgency of having to make this modification? We had a constituent come in who expressed a dissatisfaction and an unfairness of a fee.
Yeah, Representative Smith, we needed, this was this gentleman's bill and the committee, we needed it to put something else in, and the committee felt like this was also something that we should look into doing. They felt it was important. Okay. So we looked for a vehicle that we could actually do this in. So that's somewhat of the history.
I will follow your lead, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I can't remember the file that we gutted and stuffed his bill, but he had testimony with pictures of his van lined up right alongside other vans, and this is a motorhome and this is not. They're all the same size. It's just the way that you tricked them out on the inside, and then it's your word against someone else's. John Phillips is a state employee who is impeccably honest, and he says, mine is the same as everyone else's, except that mine is at a much greater cost. And so we felt to try and accommodate that whole group of people that had those 14-foot and smaller ones that were in fact motorhomes, but were treated with a much higher fee.
Thank you.
So I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing, and we'll get the amendments right and bring this back. And I'm going to go ahead. I've lost my list here. Open. Right. House Bill 2997, the sponsor of the bill has asked to pull the bill. He doesn't want to move it forward anymore. We have permission from the speaker, and so we're going to pass that one by. And now I'm going to...
Which bill is that?
2997. And we'll move on. And we have House Bill 2930. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2930.
Madam Chair, members, House Bill 2930 allows the Department of Transportation to waive the issuance, renewal, or replacement fee of identification cards for indigent people. We do have a Dash 1 amendment. That amendment replaces the language that the new language you're seeing in House Bill 2930. It's repeated twice because it's under current law as well as under the 2005 Oregon laws, Chapter 775. So we're repeating the same language in two places, and essentially it provides now that under the Dash 1s that the department may issue, renew, or replace an identification card without charge for a person whose household income is less than or equal to 75% of the most recent federal poverty guidelines for Oregon residents. It would allow the department to adopt rules specifying documentation that such an applicant would need to present in order to qualify for the waiver. This measure does have a referral to Ways and Means. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Well, we lost our sponsor. We're calling him back. But in the meantime, I'm going to ask Deborah Cafori, Mark Dolan, and Monica Gross.
Garacki.
Sorry. come up and get us started.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Deborah Cafori, and I'm very honored and happy to be here today before you. I am chair of the Board of Transition Projects, which is a nonprofit in Portland who serves people's basic needs as a transition from homelessness to housing. And I have a letter here from our executive director who was unable to make it today, testifying to the great need that we see on a daily basis for individuals who come before us needing our services but unable to take advantage of the multitude of social services offered to them because they lack one simple thing, which is an Oregon identification card. To you and me, the $29 fee may not seem like a huge hurdle to overcome, but for somebody who lives in a car or under a bridge, it can be extremely difficult to come up with the $29 necessary to obtain an ID, and then with that, all the services that ID opens the door to. I have with me today Mark Jolin from JOIN and Monica Garacki from the Oregon Law Center, who can testify also to the need for this bill.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members. My name is Mark Jolin. I'm the executive director of JOIN, Connecting the Street to a Home. We're a relatively small Portland nonprofit that does outreach to homeless people who are living on the streets and works with them to make a sustainable transition into permanent housing. Service providers like us around the state can only actually meet a fraction of the need of the people experiencing homelessness or at risk of homelessness. In Portland, where there's a pretty robust service infrastructure, there are on any given night about 2,000 people who are outside, and many of those folks don't have a relationship with any of the service agencies in town. And those are the people who this bill actually will probably have the biggest impact on. Because right now, many providers like JOIN can carve out the funds to purchase IDs for people who they are actively case managing or engaged with. But for the thousands of people who are not connected in Portland and around the state, if they come to us looking for assistance to acquire an ID, more often than not, they're going to be turned away. Although $29 does not sound like a lot, I can tell you that we struggle to raise the money it takes to provide these and similar items to the people who we are actively engaged with in any given year. The big problem with not having an ID, as Deborah was mentioning, is that it thwarts people's best efforts to end or prevent their own homelessness. Without an ID, they can't get legal work, they can't get into housing. Increasingly, picture ID is a prerequisite for all kinds of public benefits and commercial activity. You can't open a bank account, or in most cases, cash a check without a picture ID. Joint's currently working with a man who's on a short-term rent voucher. We're paying his rent for several months. That subsidy is coming to an end, and he has to find work if he hopes to avoid going back to the street. Unfortunately, he recently lost his ID, and so nobody's actually able to offer him employment at this time. In his case, because he's working with us, money is not the barrier to obtaining a replacement ID. But for many in his circumstance who don't have an agency relationship, it would be. The barriers created by the lack of ID don't just adversely affect low-income people. They have significant cost impacts on the community as a whole. If a disabled person's lack of ID sets them back just 1 month in accessing benefits, that's $600 in lost federal cash assistance to that individual and to the local service system. The same is true if there's a delay in getting TANF benefits or food stamp benefits. If a person spends 10 extra days in a shelter while they try to get the $29 together to get an ID, that costs the system $200 in shelter resources that could have been given to another person. And if a person is stopped by the police on a reasonable suspicion and doesn't have an ID, often the officer will have to take that person down to the precinct just to establish identification, a process that costs us all a lot more than $29. So in order to establish, we tried to do a little bit of a fiscal impact on this because it's obviously going to cost some money, and I wanted to explain to you briefly how we got the numbers we came up with. We're looking at a range of fiscal impact from between $161,000 to $240,000 per year. And what we did is we took the total number of identifications that DMV had issued. We took the percentage of the Oregon population above 16 that is at 75% of poverty or below. And then we multiplied the resulting number, and we ended up with about 11,800 IDs that could have been vouchered in 2005 had this bill been in place. Now, that assumes every single one of those IDs would have had a fee waiver. But that isn't going to happen in this case, because the way this mechanism is set up, a person wanting a waiver is going to have to come to a social service agency or a participating government agency and request the waiver and bring the documentation. And it will be up to the agencies to make the income assessment and to issue the voucher. Now, being very conservative, we said 70% of the people accessing IDs in this income bracket would get vouchers, and if that happened, there'd be $240,000 a year impact. In my experience and the experience of others that I've talked to in the provider community, the barrier created by making someone come in to our agencies to get a voucher probably would cut the number in half. So you'd be looking there at about $161,000 fiscal impact. And again, it's going to help that mechanism. While it's going to create some administrative burden for us as agencies, we'll also make sure that you're really getting those folks for whom the $29 is in fact a significant barrier to accessing services. I'll just close by saying that in this day and age, access to ID has become critical to full participation in our society. It's necessary and appropriate to have a mechanism by which very low-income people are able to obtain one without charge. I'd urge you to vote this bill to pass out of committee. Thank you.
Madam Chair, could I ask a question?
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you so much for your presentation. Could you explain to us what the process is to get an ID?
Madam Chair, Representative Tomei, the process currently to get an identification or under this bill?
Both.
Okay. Well, currently you would go to a local DMV office and present a variety of documentation that's required in order to establish your identity. It, in fact, includes a picture ID itself often. And you would pay your fee of $29, and they would provide you with...
Can I follow up?
Yeah.
So how would someone get the initial documentation that you're referring to?
In order to establish identity for DMV's purposes?
Mm-hmm. Or Well, for your purposes, you're saying
they're different. The documentation that would be involved when they came to our agency would be to demonstrate their income. So DMV would promulgate some regulations saying that in order to be entitled for a waiver of the fee, you have to present the following evidence of income. And so someone would come to us, to my agency, show me their tax return or their most recent pay stub. I would be able to certify that they were, in fact, at or below 75% of income, of the poverty level, excuse me. I would then issue them a voucher. They would then take that voucher to DMV along with all of their proof of identity, so their social security card and their birth certificate and the various things that DMV requires to prove identity, and together they would present those and would be able to get their identification.
Follow up.
If
they don't have those materials, then they would not be able to get this.
That's right. We're not changing with this in any way the documentation that's required in order to prove identity in order to get an ID.
Right. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Okay. Go ahead.
Good afternoon. Can you hear me okay?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. My name is Monica Garacki, and I'm a staff attorney at the Oregon Law Center in Portland, and I focus on homelessness. I provide legal services to homeless individuals through outreach, education, individual case representation, systemic advocacy, and impact litigation. I also support and help implement the city's 10-year plan to end homelessness, and I coordinate the legal assistance section at Project Homeless Connect. In the almost 2 years that I've held this job, I've spoken with hundreds of people experiencing homelessness. Often, the barriers they face to getting off the streets are quite severe. Sometimes the barriers are not so enormous, but they become so given the other realities of their lives. Identification is a really good example of this. As you've heard, a state ID card costs $29, which isn't a lot, but many of my clients have no income at all. They sleep outside or in shelters, and they rely on social service agencies to meet their basic needs, or they just go without. They just cannot scrape together the $29 to get an ID. And as you've also heard, there's a long list of things they cannot get without an ID. Employers require ID for a job. Landlords require ID to rent an apartment. Banks require ID to open an account. Check cashing outlets, a lot of people have to use those, and they require ID to cash a check. You have to show ID to get food stamps, and food stamps are the only source of income for a single adult who doesn't have a job or other benefits or children. And there's a really frustrating catch-22 in that you have to have an ID to get copies of the documents that are required to get a replacement ID. You know what I mean? So you have to show ID to get a copy of your birth certificate and also to get a replacement Social Security card. So without an ID, in fact, you can't even get into the Social Security office because it's in a federal building. And now you have to have a picture ID just to get into any federal building. So homeless people often end up losing their belongings. Sometimes they're stolen. And so they actually get in this catch-22 all the time. And like Mark was saying, it really ends up prolonging their homelessness. I mentioned I work with Project Homeless Connect, and we've held 4 Project Homeless Connect events in Portland, and hundreds of people there have asked for assistance to get IDs. It's consistently one of the most requested items at that event. And I think that reflects how crucial ID is to the other steps that people need to take to end their homelessness. Project Homeless Connect has been so successful that it's inspired other events throughout the state, from, I think, the Eugene-Springfield area to Washington County. And they're adopting this model, and I really feel that if, you know, providers or the agencies participating could offer these vouchers for IDs at Project Homeless Connect, I am sure that it would directly lead to people ending their homelessness across the state. I just want to tell you quickly about 2 individuals that I know who have been affected by their inability to get ID. The first one, client of mine, he was a man in his early 30s, homeless. He had autism and some different physical health problems. He had worked, actually, for many years as an assistant to a roofer. And unfortunately, he had a disagreement with his employer. He lost his job, and then he couldn't pay his rent, so he was evicted. And by the time I met him, he had been living outside in a kind of hidden in the woods in a, at a campsite for months and months. And the primary reason that he was in that situation was that he could not get another job or a place to live because he did not have an ID. And we worked really hard to try to fix his situation. And during this time, his camp was swept, and he lost all of his meager belongings, but it was everything he had, and he lost that stuff. The second person was a client, not of mine, but with another nonprofit that I work with, and she was in her 50s, had been homeless for 19 years. She had mental health issues that she was dealing with, which I think were her primary reason for being where she was. She was sleeping outside, and this nonprofit had helped her apply for both subsidized housing and disability benefits. She had a copy of her birth certificate. She did not have any ID and no other identifying documents. The subsidized housing provider that she would be able to work with, they had to see ID before they would accept her into housing. But again, with this catch-22, she couldn't get an ID card without the other secondary documents that are required by DMV. And actually, they would have taken a Social Security card, but she couldn't get that. She couldn't even get into the Social Security building without an ID. And I believe the way that situation was resolved was the client, the nonprofit that she was working with, really, you know, jumped through hoops and did everything they could and kind of got a way to sort of get around the rules. But it was, I mean, she was on the street much longer than she would have needed to be but for that situation. So I wish I could tell you about all the folks and, you know, everyone that does this work knows many people in this situation, but I know you probably have other things to do. So I just want to urge you to do what you can to have this go forward. It's going to really make a huge difference to the clients that I work with, and I really appreciate your time hearing us today. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll go ahead, committee, and... hear what Representative Shields has to say, and then if you have any questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've got to get down to chairing my committee, and I appreciate your indulgence. I just wanted to thank you for allowing us to have this public hearing. I know particularly this late in the session that you've got a very large agenda that you're trying to get through. I think that Monica, Mark, and the former Democratic leader and my predecessor in District 43 said it all very well. I think this is a very good humanitarian bill, and if you did decide that you wanted to send this down to Ways and Means sometime over the next week and a half, I just wanted to assure you that I would make sure that the funds required for this wouldn't come out of any of your committee's priorities. So thank you very much for that.
Nice sales job, Derek.
Questions? Representative Butler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The former representative from District 43 sure has a better looking appearance and nicer hair.
Nicer hair, yeah.
I had a couple of questions, and probably to Monica. Monica, lots of barriers for these folks, not the least of which is how much does it cost for a certified copy of a birth certificate?
I think it's $20. We were talking about that. Yeah, there was another person I didn't tell you about who needed to get his birth certificate, which itself was a big hurdle. So you're absolutely right. I believe it's $20. And that's, that's if it takes a while, if you need it right away, it's $50, I think. So, yeah, that's a hurdle, too.
So if I could follow up, there's just it looks like to me that we've got layers of various kinds of concerns as we try and get these folks with they need an address to who, and I'm assuming that working with the nonprofits that you and Mark work with, that there's probably an address that you can have them send their mail to send a copy of their Social Security card or to start to accumulate any of this other information that they've got, so that there's a folder on them at one particular location where there are people there that they have confidence in that aren't going to take advantage of them. And that's, you know, that's part of the, you know, you had mentioned one client with mental health issues. You know, perhaps that particular person didn't have confidence in anybody. Had been enrolled so many times by the system that, you know, just doesn't know when the next shoe is going to fall. I have a concern. I have a number of IDs in my cart for me, just for myself, but have been issued by various police departments. I have an ID that's issued by my sheriff back home. I have an ID from a city police department. What of local IDs? Are those available to these people to get them through this, or must it be only the $29 DMV ID?
I don't know of a local issuer of picture identification, and so I think it needs to be a state-issued or a government-issued ID. I don't know of anyone in Portland, Multnomah County that's issuing identification. Now, there are veterans' cards that some folks carry, and those will help in certain circumstances. But I think our experience is that folks need to have a state-issued, an official state ID in order to access the full range of services. I haven't actually tried to take a VA ID and get into the federal courthouse or open a bank account. I can't tell you for sure. But it's definitely, in terms of what the request is to us from folks, it's very much around having that state identification card.
And Chair Rhett Butler.
Go ahead.
I think with the increased awareness on terrorism and homeland security, people are getting more and more strict, and the chance for people to pass off identification that is not legitimate is always a concern. So I think people are going to be more strict about wanting an Oregon state ID in specific.
But if I can follow up, I know that your sheriff department in Multnomah County and every county of the state will issue a picture ID. Will, in fact. I don't know what the cost is. I think the last time I had one done for my courthouse in Vail, the sheriff charged me, I think, a few dollars for it. It's a matter of lining up at the door printing out a form. That is a government-issued ID.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking now about to sell hot dogs on your street corners, you're going to have a vendor's license. A vendor's license is my recollection that when they issue those vendor licenses, you got to go down to the Department of whatever in Portland, and they issue some kind of a vendor's license. It's a government vendor's license, and I don't know if it's pictured or not. I think the last one I saw in a large city was, in fact, a picture ID showing that they were, in fact, a legitimate, legal, authorized vendor to be on the street corner. So I know that there's veterans. I know that the city police department will issue IDs. I know that I absolutely know that our sheriff's offices, 36 sheriff's offices in the state, do issue government IDs, and it doesn't cost $29. I can't remember how much I did pay for mine from Allier County, but I still have it in the car, and I still use it from time to time for purposes of when I need to check in, and that's the only ID I have in the car. So while it's preferable probably to have a DMV card, we're still talking about the cost of certified birth certificates and some other documentation which still has to be accumulated before you get there. And I'm wondering if we've really tried working with our local sheriff's departments and our local city police to assist in those kinds of matters. These are local issues. I have concerns for my constituents in Vail, Oregon, and Harper, Oregon, that can't get to the local DMV office, which isn't in Vail or in Harper. So those are still some concerns I have. But they could get to the courthouse in Vail, and they could get to the police department in Nisa, Oregon. So just by way of suggestion.
Thank you. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good seeing you, Democratic Leader Kofori.
Thank you.
Let me start off by saying thank you to each of you for your compassion for Oregon's most vulnerable. I think this is a indication of good legislation where you're able to step forward and see a need or a problem, if you will, and figure out how to remove that barrier. I'm sorry. Terrible microphones. I apologize. Just so we can understand the citizens, the demographics of the citizens we're working with, do any of you know what is the federal poverty guideline? And I don't expect you to quote. I'm just curious, for one person, what dollar amount constitutes?
What I know is what 75% is. It's somewhere under $700 a month.
$700 a month.
Okay. So
times 12, you're $8,400.
Something like that.
Wow. I guess just an observation, Madam Chair. Recently, our family's been trying to get passports in order for us to take a trip, and one of the things we had to do was get a birth certificate, a couple copies, and I'll tell you what, that's like pulling teeth. And so I can't even imagine how difficult it would be for someone who's homeless, for someone who's indigent, to try and get an identification card. I mean, I think Representative Tomei was asking the perfect question. What if you don't have any papers? What do you do? And so often we ask folks to pull themselves up by the bootstraps. Well, that's great, but we also at the same time have to be able to assist them so they can pull themselves up. And I think this is an example of good government that helps folks pull themselves up and helps those who are most vulnerable. So thank you for bringing it forward.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
No other questions?
No, I do have a quick question, okay. If I may. What is, for a single person, what is 75% of the federal poverty level?
Chair, Representative May, it's about somewhere under $700 a month. I want to say it's $660 or somewhere.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you. Roger Martin, I'll bring up three of you, Jack Evans and Alex.
Madam Chair, I'm just an observation. I'm a little concerned about the items in Representative Butler's car, so if he knows the distinction between IDs and warrants.
to some of the things. Warrants have pictures on them.
Wanted posters.
Not a picture.
Oh, yeah.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Roger Martin. I'm signing up in opposition, but I want to quickly add that I'm politically astute enough to read the sponsors of the bill. The majority of this committee are co-sponsors of this bill. And transit certainly is not in any way opposed to trying to help the indigent in some way. As a matter of fact, it was mentioned earlier, the Project Homeless Connect, TriMet gives free tickets to anybody that's involved with that. I just want to bring up the chief sponsor of the bill, Representative Shields, mentioned he did not want to take this out of any of your favorite projects, and that's my problem. You're taking this out of my favorite project. All of the funds from the ID cards go to the elderly and disabled. We've been before this committee describing to you the need for more money for elderly and disabled, and whatever you raise is going to come right out of us, not out of anywhere else. I wish there were another way to fund this. And part of your problem is you look at ODOT, you cannot ask ODOT to use ODOT funds because they can't use the gas tax for this purpose. So the project that's being asked for is immensely important and should be funded, but I just don't want you to fund it out of the desperately short funds we already have because we've been before your committee asking, please give us more. Thank you.
Thank you.
I can't let it go, Madam Chair. Roger, how many of your clients overlap? How many of your clients overlap with the clients that we're talking about previously? How many of your clients in the senior and disabled are 75% of the federal poverty income?
Madam Chair, Representative, I wouldn't have any way of answering that. I'm sure there's a percentage that do overlap. Hear me clearly.
I think there's a need for this card. I just don't want it to be funded out of the funds that are going to the elderly and disabled.
It's a fair observation. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Who's next?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Alex Kyler. I'm a legislative analyst for the City of Eugene. For the record, City of Eugene supports House Bill 2930. In January 2007, over 2,278 people were counted in the Lane County's one-night homelessness count, and we felt that many more were not counted. Also in February, the Homeless Connect of Lane County held a special one-day event where 95 agencies and 350 volunteers set up at the Lane County Fairgrounds to provide a variety of service to homeless people. We anticipated 500 attendees showing up. Over twice that many people showed up, 1,007 to be exact, for a variety of free services: medical attention, haircuts, veterans benefits, legal assistance, housing referrals. There were even volunteer bicycle mechanics who fixed over 100 bicycles, many without brakes, because people who have to choose between brakes and food choose to eat. At this event, our homeless citizens consistently showed great interest in digging out of their predicament. There are numerous barriers for homeless people trying to get on their feet. The lack of proper identification is one of them. For people who are trying to survive each day and find resources for food, the cost of an ID card is too great a price. We urge you to pass this bill. There isn't one solution to homelessness. The solutions will come in a variety of actions and forms. Each is a small but important step, and the City of Eugene urges you to take this one. Thank you for your time and consideration today. We urge you to do pass recommendation.
Thank you.
Jack. Chair Byer, members of the committee, Jack Evans of the Department of Transportation. House Bill 2930 will authorize DMV to issue original, renewal, or replacement IDs to indigent individuals without charge. Currently, the department issues 131,000 IDs each year. The costs are $29 for an original, $25 for a renewal, or $24 for a replacement, and the cards are valid for a period of 8 years. This bill does not define, or did not define, I guess we're now looking at the -1 amendments that give us a definition of indigent, which was one of our issues. We didn't have a definition of how you would define an indigent person, so it was difficult for us to get our arms around the impact of financial impact of this. But the definition, whichever definition is used, it's important to remember that DMV won't be determining doing a means test or a needs test on individuals. That'll be left to professional social service agencies. And you heard in earlier testimony, these community agencies will provide a test for individuals and receive the necessary documents, and then provide DMV. That individual would then present DMV with a voucher that they in turn would use to give them an ID card. It doesn't change the requirements for the ID card as far as the documentation you have to present, and that often is, as was mentioned, quite a difficult thing, and it's getting tighter with all we're hearing about Homeland Security issues and ID theft. It's not loosening up at all, so there are some challenges for a lot of individuals that want to get ID cards. We're not sure exactly how many individuals would be out there, but we heard an estimate in earlier testimony that perhaps 11 to 12,000 individuals with $161,000 to $240,000 being expended every year for this. And we're ready to put this together, but you need to realize, as was mentioned, that since this is an ID card as opposed to a driver's license, we're not allowed to use the highway fund, so this comes out of the transportation operating fund. And currently, the ID card revenue that DMV expects in the 2005-2007 biennium is about $6.9 million. And by statute, DMV retains 45% of that to cover the costs of the program issuing IDs, which is $3.1 million. And the remaining 55% of that, or $3.8 million in this example, is then by statute sent to the elderly and disabled transit program. So those are the two places that we direct the funds from the ID revenue. It's to run the program, to cover our costs, and then the remainder of it is sent to elderly and disabled transit. And those funds are then distributed to counties, to transportation districts, to tribes, etc., according to formulas that are based on population. And then some portion of that is federal matches federal dollars for higher need areas. So that's the issue, I think, is the funds that we collect for ID cards currently go to senior and disabled, the elderly and disabled transit program, and perhaps there is an overlap of some of those individuals, but that's the reality of it. So should this pass, we'll certainly work with the parties to put together the rules and the processes to make it work and to set up the voucher system and do what we need to do to make this happen.
Representative Reed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Jack, can you give us some, and perhaps I missed it, a breakdown on how many of the 131,000 are renewals or replacements versus originals, and if you have a sense of what the marginal cost would be on a replacement as opposed to a new one?
Chair Beyer, Representative Reed, I'm sorry, I don't have that information. This is an aggregate figure that I was given.
Any other questions?
Madam Chair.
Yes. Representative Butler.
So if I understand the testimony of Roger Martin, his concern is that, and I didn't connect the dots until Jack's testimony, is that of the $6.9 million for gross income for issuance fees, 55% of that then goes back to the elderly and disabled programs to assist them with purchasing transit passes and for other local poor and disabled folks. And so we've got right now a system that's charging as much as $29 for an original new application, but it sounds like about half of that is quote unquote their cost, and the other half is quote unquote the profit, which goes back to the senior disabled programs. If that's the testimony that's offered today, and we're going to send this, if we send this to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation, then we're taking it out of one pocket and moving it over to another with some administration costs that DMV is going to have to implement. Is that what I'm hearing from the testimony here today?
Yes, Representative Butler.
And Madam Chair, I still would come back and ask Alex from the city of Eugene, if you've got somewhere between 1,070 to 2,278 homeless people in Eugene, does the city of Eugene or the local metropolitan government issue any kind of picture ID to anyone for anything at present, and how much is your cost to do that?
We do. Chair Beyer, Representative Butler, to answer your question, we do offer an identification card that I am aware of for certain for employees and for those companies that we do provide a business license to, specifically taxi drivers, are photographed. For that license, I believe the fee is, $55. $75 for the first one, and then it's like $55 or $35 for subsequent ones. Now, in hearing the testimony earlier, I'm not exactly sure how, for instance, the federal government defines, you know, a government-issued identification. If that meets the standard, I'm unaware.
Madam Chair, I just a follow-up. I know that for here for the city of Salem, I believe it's Marion County, that we have bus passes that has our picture on it. So I know that there are other governmental organizations that issue on a fairly regular basis a picture photo ID. Now, it may only be for this transit area, and you've got Lane Transit down where you live, Alex, but my concern is that you may have, I don't know how much those are. I don't remember how much we paid for our Marion County Transit passes, but I don't think it was $29 for just the picture pass itself that gets you on with your other whatever it is that you've got to have. But I'm just looking for a cheaper way that perhaps these folks wouldn't have to go to the DMV offices, because in some of the rural areas that some of us represent, it's not that close to a DMV office. It'd be closer to a city hall, for instance. I'm still searching, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Madam Chair.
Representative Tomei.
My math skills aren't what they used to be. But we're talking about the possibility, of course we don't have a fiscal yet, but from what previous testimony, it may be about $200,000. I guess that was a year, wasn't it?
That was a year.
Mm-hmm. And it's $3.8 million goes to the elderly and disabled transit. Is that a biennium or a year?
So it was 3.8.
Chair Beyer, Representative Tomei, that's a biennium. That was the estimate for the 2005-07 biennium.
Okay, so it would be approximately 1% of that amount would apparently pay for this. Is that true? Is my math anywhere close to that?
Chair Beyer, Representative Tomei, you're asking the wrong person.
I think it's considerably greater than 1%, but I could be wrong in the math. I took some calculations of biennial and annual, and it looked like to me that the total cost was 11,800 voucherable IDs at $29. I calculated that at $342,000.
Oh, we were given the potential fiscal between 161,000 and 240,000. So I was sort of getting in the middle there.
And I was using the testimony, I think, from Monica Baraki, or maybe it was Mark Jolin that from Join that said they were $29 a piece, and then there was some testimony that there was about 11,800 of them that would be voucherable, he thought. And I just took the $29. Now, I think Monica indicated that some of them had just been lost, which would be a lesser fee than the $29. I think $23, they said.
Well, maybe we could get a fiscal and get a little more clarity on this.
Representative Smith.
For my 2 cents, and I know Chair or Representative Butler was chair of the Economic Development, Transportation, Ways and Means, and so was I, and Representative Tomei, your vice chair right now. The one thing that was shared with us when we were chairing those committees was we were relying on the policy committees to determine what is good public policy and then to send it to Ways and Means to let them worry about how to pay for it. And so I think I'm of the opinion this is good public policy. I think we should pass this. I think we should send it to Ways and Means. And while I'm fully supportive of what Roger's saying, who knows, maybe Betsy and Representative Tomei can find a different funding stream to fill the backflow of this issue. And you know, this is why Chair Johnson gets the big bucks. She can worry about all these issues because there's more than this bill down there to deal with dealing with ODOT. So
thank you. We have June, and I'm not going to pronounce the last name. June and Benjamin. Kennedy?
Forsyth Kennedy.
June Forsyth Kennedy. Thank you.
And I have a son who is mentally handicapped and also mentally ill. I went through the picture ID process for him, and it is $50 on the internet for a birth certificate, and $20 if you can wait a month, then the fees at the DMV. Represent organizations that are working with the homeless in Lebanon, and we've had several cases where, in order to get a picture ID for a person that places will accept, that is verified with a birth certificate and a Social Security number, which I don't think the sheriff's offices do. I could be mistaken, but I know Costco. You can get a picture ID from Costco, but all it takes is to stand there and pay your dues, you know. So the picture IDs from the DMV require more verification that you are who you say you are. And so in order to get some of those for our people in Lebanon, some of our volunteers have actually paid the fees for the homeless people in Lebanon. There's a man who works at the Albany Helping Hand Shelter, works for his board and room, essentially. He gets a Social Security amount income of $500 a month. His rent is $400 a month. And in Lebanon, we've been trying to rent apartments for some of our homeless people, and we've been trying to find one for $350, and we can't. So, you know, it's going to be more than that. It'll probably be at least $400 a month. And so, when their income, you know, they're paying way more than half their income for housing, those that have any housing. So it affects not just those that are homeless, but those that are poor, and. I guess that's all I have to say.
Thank you.
I'm Ben Kanegi. We're husband and wife, and both on the board of the Lebanon Emergency Shelter. I really have nothing to add here, but Madam Chair, if it's not out of order, I would like to ask a question in regard to funding. Would it be possible to raise the fees for the rest of us who can afford it from 29 to 30 or 31 to cover what this waiver would cost you?
Committee. Thank you. I know it's always anytime we have to raise any type of revenue, it takes a little higher number of votes and gets a little trickier.
I suspect so.
Yes.
Thank you.
Well, that's all I had signed up. I don't know if there was anyone else. Seeing none, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing and thank everybody for coming. And open a public hearing on House Bill 2988.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. House Bill 2988 decreases the transit system fee for persons over 65 years of age from 50% to 20% of the regular fee for transportation provided by any transit district. This measure does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Tom Powers, legislative assistant to Representative Mitch Greenlick, who serves the people of House District 33 from Northwest Portland over across Sunset Highway to North Plains, actually. And he is the sponsor of House Bill 2988 at the request of the Friendly House Senior Program. He could actually not be here today because he is unfortunately chairing two hearings on stem cell research and fluoridation. So his services are very much required there, and I'm left to testify to your esteemed committee today. Basically, just to summarize the mechanics of the bill, what House Bill 2988 proposes is a reduction in the percentage of rates for honored citizens, senior citizens, persons of 65 years of age or older. Currently, that is set at 50%, that transit districts can charge no more than 50% of the regular fare for these individuals. This bill proposes a reduction in that percentage, or an increased discount, if you were, to 20%. So that would be basically an 80% discount. So I guess one of the arguments that Representative Greenlake wanted to make was that the position of 50% discount is already set, and this just further increases that discount, as it were. And I've been instructed by legislative counsel that sometimes committees are able to do a conceptual amendment. So if the committee did not find 20% to its satisfaction, it could replace that number with something in between 20 and 50%. Some of the reasons we brought this bill forward is that while seniors are on fixed incomes and depend only on cost of living raises every couple of years that are set by Social Security, they are still subject to rate hikes and fare hikes from transit districts, and it should be noted that senior citizens depend on public transit a lot more than persons aged 18 to 65, especially for medical visits and other things that they really need to get rides to. And this is especially true in light of proposed laws that would restrict or limit the driving privileges of senior citizens that are being considered. Transit districts under this bill would still be allowed to charge regular fees during high-capacity rush hour times. That is already provided in statute under ORS 267.320. And I guess don't have any more points to make, so I will answer any questions as best I can, if there are any.
Representative Buckley.
Madam Chair, thank you very much. And perhaps Representative Gillen might be able to help me on this one, too. My concern is that when you lower a fee for a transit district, my understanding is with the dial-a-ride component for seniors and disabled, the district can only charge twice what the fixed route charge is. So if, for instance, the Rogue Valley Transportation District has a $2 fee and it's already reduced down to $1 for a senior, then the dial-a-ride portion, the door-to-door portion, they would only be able to charge $2 for that service. And with the district in my county being in such financial trouble, I have just great concern that this would make life even harder for them to provide the services they need, not only for seniors, but for the full populace. So I just wanted to express that concern.
Thank you, Chair Beyer, Representative Buckley. This was composed to address basically monthly fares for passes on public transportation districts, and apparently there are other funding streams and costs that are tied to that would probably be affected by this that have not been fully considered, and I do appreciate you bringing that to my attention.
Thank you. Any other questions? Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you.
Roger Martin.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Roger Martin, the Executive Director of the Oregon Transit Association, and Representative Buckley just gave my testimony. I felt like so. Our concern simply is that the recovery from fares for most transit system is something highly criticized by most legislators. When we ask for more money, we say, well, you only get, in TriMet's case, 23% back. Our problem is simply the one that Representative Buckley pointed out. We are already hurting badly for revenue. And you'd be interested to know that TriMet presently discounts beyond the statute limitation of 50 to those social service agencies serving the kind of elderly that I think we're aiming at here. There are a lot of elderly, I'm sitting here as one of them, who can readily afford to pay the full fare. We get a discount already. I don't know how far we can go down on this. The There are some districts in the state, and I think the Rogue Valley Transportation District is illustrative of it, barely surviving right now, cutting vital routes. The route to Rogue Valley Hospital has been eliminated because of the problem serving it, and this is just one more niche that we appreciate. Representing Green Lake as one of the best supporters of transit in this building, so I'm hesitant to testify, but I just have to be honest. Sometimes there's too much of a good thing.
Questions? Well, that was easy for you.
Thank you.
Thank you. I don't have anyone else signed up, and I'm not seeing anybody jump up. So, Representative,
I just
have
one question. This extra 30% in times of financial crises for the particularly local governments. Was there any thought as to where it might come from?
Just
a great idea on behalf of the Friendly House Senior Program.
Yes, I assume so. Do you want to respond at all? Whether he thought they were just flush with money, or whether he was concerned about where it would come from.
I appreciate the thought, Chair Beyer, Representative Butler. The figure, what we were trying to do here is that TriMet passes for senior citizens on a monthly rate have increased from $12, I think, from a few years ago, and they've doubled to nearly $24. I think they're at $23 right now. And I think it's a growth factor of twofold, whereas a lot of the other passes have increased from like about $50 or $60 to $74 right now. So you're looking at a 200% increase the rate of a fare for senior citizens is doubled, where their income has only increased by a few percentage points because that's fixed based on Social Security and other sources of income. Some elderly who are employed by lobbying firms, notwithstanding, or others who have other sources of income, notwithstanding, of course.
Madam Chair, if I could interrupt Tom for just a moment. Tom, is there any indication that any of these that are presented to us are awash in money at this particular point?
Chair Beyer, Representative Butler, this bill proposed to decrease the fee, and all these districts are hurting for money. That is true, but we did want to bring attention to the fact that rate hikes disproportionately hurt senior citizens who depend on public transportation the most. And you know, this was kind of one statement to make, and then from there we could kind of figure out how we can help senior citizens better afford public transportation, whether that's an increase in the elderly and disabled transit assistance provided by, I think, the Department of Transportation, or other ideas. And this is another alternative to that. If, because of financial reasons, we cannot increase that subsidy provided by the elderly and disabled transit assistance.
Madam Chair, I just have to say this, and this is the Transportation Committee, but when I first started coming to Salem for these meetings, I could fill my car up for $20. I pulled into the station the other day, it was nearly $60. So I can appreciate, but what Tom is saying on behalf of Representative Greenlink, but by the same token, none of them are awash in money, and they're barely keeping their heads above ground by forcing another 30% reduction on their revenues from a group of seniors without doing what Roger had indicated, maybe means testing the seniors first, really just forces it. It makes a bad situation worse, it appears to me, and I don't mean to say anything about representing Greenlink's good desires. It's just that the local governments just don't have any more money than what we do either.
Thank you. Thank you again. Thanks. I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2988, and it appears that we can go ahead and open the public hearing on House Bill 3274.
Madam Chair, members, House Bill 3274 would increase from 10,000 pounds to 14,000 pounds the gross vehicle weight that a truck can weigh and still travel the maximum allowable speed limit rather than be bound by 55 miles per hour or below. This measure does not have any subsequent referrals. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Judith. Jim Geisinger. Come up.
Do we have an SMS and I'm just missing it?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Jim Geisinger. I'm the Executive Vice President of Associated Oregon Loggers. We're a trade group representing 1,100 small family-owned logging companies and businesses associated with the logging industry. I appreciate you granting us a hearing on this very simple but very important bill to our members. It's a very common-sense issue with a degree of fairness and also a degree of economic efficiency that our members are concerned about. It has to do with the definition of commercial vehicles relative to the speed limits that they have to comply with on the lower end of the weight threshold for requiring commercial license plates, or what we refer to as T plates. Currently, any vehicle with a commercial or with a gross vehicle weight of over 14,000 pounds requires a T plate and by statute cannot travel greater than 55 miles an hour. In our industry, this often means heavy-duty pickups with maybe a little equipment in the back, perhaps an auxiliary fuel tank that makes the gross vehicle weight in excess of 14,000 pounds. Large pickups is what we're talking about in the instance of our members' concerns. On the other hand, a Monaco coach weighing 55,000 pounds and towing an SUV can blow past our guys doing 65 or 70 miles an hour when the pickup is putting along at 55. We think that poses a hazard for other vehicles on the road, and it certainly is an inconvenience for individuals who typically work 12, 14, 16 hours days and would like to get to where they want to go as quickly as they can. So that's the dilemma that we're currently facing. Neighboring states have very different rules about how fast these sorts of vehicles can travel. In California, these kinds of vehicles can travel 70 miles an hour, in Idaho 75 miles an hour, and 60 miles an hour in the state of Washington. Our original intent, frankly, was to allow any vehicle under 26,000 pounds gross vehicle weight to comply with the posted speed limits. That's the threshold for requiring a commercial driver's license. ODOT had some concerns about that because they do have the authority to grant waivers for certain types of vehicles like school buses, school activity buses, worker transport vehicles, church activity buses, and so forth, where they can allow them to go no higher than 60 miles an hour because of a statutory limitation requiring at least a 5-mile-per-hour differential lower than the posted 65 miles an hour. So their concern was that if we went to 26,000 pounds, that they would have to repost all of the mileage signs on the interstate, noting that the big rigs could go 55, medium-sized trucks could go 60, and everyone else could go 65. That's an expense they weren't willing or able under current financial situation to adhere to. So we negotiated the 14,000 pounds. It wasn't exactly a scientific effort. Our process, we said 26, they said 10, we said 18, they said 12, and we ended up at 14,000. So I'm just here simply to ask for your support of making this very minor adjustment in Oregon statutes, but one that we think is very important to the lighter weighted commercial vehicles. We don't believe that it posts any additional safety hazards on the road. In fact, according to ODOT's own data, it shows that for commercial vehicles weighing less than 26,000 pounds, we're involved in 14 to 15 crashes on the interstate each year between 2001 and 2005. This is about 3% of all commercial vehicle crashes on the interstate, and that's for vehicles under 26,000 pounds. They don't have data, obviously, for vehicles under 14,000 pounds, but logic would tell you it's a percentage of the 3%. So we're talking about a very, very small amount of additional risk, perhaps maybe not even calculable. So with that, I'll I know everyone wants to go home this evening, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. But again, it's simply to allow vehicles that exceed 10,000 pounds but less than 14,000 pounds with T-plates to comply with the posted speed limit on the interstate, which is currently 65 miles per hour.
Thank you. Representative Gilman.
Jim, can you give me any statistics on the number of tickets these pickups have gotten? I don't like to pass a law unless I see a need. And in your testimony, I don't see any of that kind of statistic.
Chair Beyer, Representative Gilman, we looked for that data. Trust me, ODOT does not have statistics that are specific to the number of convictions for speeding on the interstate for trucks over 10,000 pounds but less than 26,000 pounds. We attempted to poll our members and did not get a particularly good response just in terms of people responding. But on the other hand, I guess the response to your concern about not wanting to pass unnecessary laws is our members don't want to unnecessarily violate any existing laws. And it might be fine to say, well, you know, they all go 65 and they don't get ticketed, but there always might be the state patrolman who got up on the wrong side of the bed and decided to ticket a guy for doing 65 when he should have been doing 55. We would prefer to operate legally rather than have a wink and a nod agreement and say, drive 65, you won't get caught.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sir, I think you bring a very logical argument forward. The fact is, you're right, recreational vehicles hauling their Acura behind them can go 65 miles an hour, and for the most part, those folks perhaps drive their recreational vehicles once, twice, maybe three times a year. The folks you're talking about are experienced drivers on the highway every day, driving with these loads every day. I guess the one observation I have, and this is a rural Oregon observation, I actually think there's a safety hazard having these trucks go 55 miles an hour on the freeway rather than the 65. In rural eastern Oregon, quite often the traffic does get up to 70, and you start getting into certain parts of I-84, and my goodness, you come up on a car going or a truck going 55 miles an hour. Quite often, that could be a hazard. And so, sir, I think you bring a logical argument forward. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Seeing none. Thank you, Troy Casales. Hello.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Ms. Collins. My name is Troy Costales, Administrator of the Safety Division for the Oregon Department of Transportation. In my written testimony, there's just two things I'd like to highlight for you, is that the change from the 10,000 to the 14,000 is broad and wide open. And the gentleman before me that testified is talking about one particular set of vehicles. There's a lot of vehicles that are likely going to fit into here. The difficulty is saying, what are those? Because there is no tracking database in the DMV records or the registration records in relationship to who fits into this 10 to 14,000 gross vehicle weight rating. You have to look at it from the manufacturer's point of view to see who fits in here. But it's a broad spectrum, the high-end, heavier pickups, but it's also relating to vans, delivery vehicles, and all kinds of other light truck modified vehicles that we're talking about. And because of the weight change, the issue here is that when there is a crash, the heavier weight at the higher speed, there's just more energy involved in the incident. The more energy, the less effective the safety features of the vehicles and of the roadside are going to work. That's the laws of physics. Just want to bring that to your attention, because that's what you're talking about, is the higher speed is a higher energy related to the crash. The second piece is stopping distance. The higher the speed, the longer the stopping distance. This weight of vehicle at night will hit what it cannot see. At night, these vehicles will be out driving the distance of their headlights when they start going above 55 miles an hour. So you have a higher threshold of energy in the crash and an issue of stopping distance just from the pure factual point of view. And all I want to do today was just raise those things for you as you have the policy debate about this particular window of vehicles as to whether or not the higher speed is something that we do out on the interstates in relationship to the 55 versus 65. These vehicles still would be required to be 55 on the county roads, the secondary state highways, and still follow all the speed limits of the local roads and streets. Those don't change. The only place where this changes is on the interstate only. And with that, Madam Chair, I'd be happy to try and answer any of the questions that the committee may have.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Troy, the state of Oregon's safety administrator, share with this committee why Washington, Idaho, and California have been able to raise theirs. What argument did they use to justify the increase?
Madam Chair and Representative Smith, I can't answer the question because within each of the jurisdictions, it's up to the individual state to make the public policy call on what's in the speed limit or not, as the gentleman in front of me talked about in relationship to the motorhome and motor coaches. That's been a debate within this building multiple times about speed limit or special licensing. It's a public policy debate that those legislatures have had that we, first time I know of for this body that we've done this particular question.
Just a quick follow-up. Thank you, Madam Chair. Would it be possible for the Department of Transportation to do a little bit of research and find out the rationale in those other states? Maybe there was a good reason to do it.
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, I'd be happy to contact my counterparts in our neighboring states to see if they happen to have history. Sometimes these things may go back a ways.
Yeah, I understand that.
Thank you, Representative Reed.
I think that was just said, Madam Chair. I was just going to clarify, and in that same effort, if you could also see what the history has been in terms of effect and results. Thanks.
That's my point as well, Madam Chair, if we could find out what the safety consequences were of a raised speed limit to 70 or 75 in neighboring states, would the changes happen?
Thank you. Everybody's on the same page.
Madam Chair, can I clarify?
Yes.
This is relating to approximately the 10 to 14,000 range, not right. Bigger, broader speed limit issues, because that'd be a book. I think you're wanting something. Okay, I'll try the best I can.
Thank you. And maybe I shouldn't put you on the spot like this, and I probably should have asked Jim on this, but what on this a little history of this bill and maybe your feeling on the negotiations that went on beforehand on how this bill came about.
Madam Chair, do you want that now or as part of the response back to you with the other?
Well, if you have it now, that'd be great.
Madam Chair, I'm not. As far as the conversation earlier about 26,000, 10,000, I wasn't party to any of those types of conversations as far as the debate goes. So I'm not going to be able to provide anything from my point of view and can double check. But the department, when last session there was the conversation around the overall speed limit and the commission came down saying here is where we are as far as the policy direction as directed by statute, our job is to then adhere to the statute and to what the commission has said, and they changed three spots on the interstate to 60 for vehicles, and so that's where we're going programmatically and with the speed program is to stay with what current law is, because that is what the commission and the director have given to us as our direction of policy.
Thank you. Any other questions? Seeing none, thank you. And I am going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 3274. And thank you, committee, and we will see you Wednesday.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes, we have at least four members on Friday. We can do our business.